It's been the policy to move toward renewable energy in Alaska for quite a few years now, but not all that easy for independent renewable energy generators to get their power into the grid. I'm Steve Heimel. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. One of the things lawmakers and regulators should consider as they begin to allow this to happen, the toll-free number 1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage of 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. What should the rules be for independent power generators? The question today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. If you're not covered by health insurance, you may be eligible for financial help with monthly premiums and out-of-pocket expenses. Open enrollment ends on February 15th. Sign up at healthcare.gov. Last year, 88% of Alaskans who enrolled received financial assistance. Compare plans and see if you qualify for financial assistance. Call 211 to get free local help. Visit getcoveredalaska.org for more information. This message sponsored by Ashna, a partner of Get Covered Alaska. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, it turns out this is a really timely show. There's a bill introduced in the legislature today with regards to this subject, and tomorrow the Regulatory Commission of Alaska is taking up an issue involving Golden Valley and that Delta Wind Farm person who has been calling the program a number of times in the past. This issue of independent generators of electrical power has come up repeatedly as we've discussed energy on Talk of Alaska. And every time it does, I say, you know, we need to do a show about that sometime. That time is now. And I don't know how far we're going to get on this because it gets complicated. There's a lot of different aspects to it, but maybe at the heart of it, it's not all that difficult to understand. So I have invited a kind of a big picture kind of person, Robert Kahn, director of the Northwest and Intermountain Power Producers Coalition, who joins us by telephone from Seattle. Bob, welcome to Talk of Alaska. How are you today?
I'm very fine, thank you, and delighted to be on the show.
So maybe if you could kind of sketch out the basic position that your organization has, you know, representing the independent power producers in terms of who takes the risks, who's best equipped to develop breakthrough technologies and that sort of thing.
All right. Well, it is a complicated topic, but we don't have to start with the complication of it. Frankly, it's very simple. It's about competition. In 1978, the Congress enacted legislation that created a thing called PURPA, the Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act, which broke up the utility's monopoly over the generation of electricity.
That's a lot of years ago. Robert, that's many years ago now.
It's taken some time, but actually 40% of the electricity generated in the lower 48 is generated by independent power producers, which is to say, independent power producers are entrepreneurs, corporations, and so forth, that are not regulated monopolies, but instead real businesses that take the risk to generate electricity and sell it at wholesale to either direct users or utilities who remarket it to consumers. So it is a major part of the energy sector in the lower 48. And the essence of it is that the Congress wanted to inject competition in the generation of electricity because it's not a natural monopoly. What could be seen, and frankly is an important thing to recognize, is that the utility's obligation, core obligation, is to keep the lights on, to maintain the distribution and the transmission of electricity, but the generation of it can come from a variety of sources and can be built out by private equity.
All right. I think I want to stop you there. Although I know you're just getting started, and turn to my other guest because I think our largest independent generator is Cook Inlet Region Incorporated, which has a wind farm on Fire Island just off the coast from Anchorage. You see it when you fly out. You see this wind farm now. And we have the Senior Director of Energy Development at Cook Inlet Region, Suzanne Gibson, with us. Suzanne, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you for having me.
I'm so happy you could come in. And I want to hear, is the wind farm right now putting power into the grid?
It certainly is. I left the office about 30 minutes ago to get here, and the project is 17 megawatts, and we were generating 14.
Wow. So I didn't even really feel much wind out there, so I guess it's a little different when you get up to the elevation and these things are.
Yeah, it's quite a bit windier over on Fire Island than it is in Anchorage.
And so it appears to have been a success to build this thing, wouldn't you say?
It has been. You know, we started the development project or the development of this project many, many years ago, you know, prior to 2009. It took us some time to get traction with one of the rail belt utilities, and we were finally able to get a power purchase agreement. Mostly, I would say, because the political winds were blowing in the right direction. And at the time that we were developing the project, there was a lot of concern about whether or not there was going to be enough natural gas in Cook Inlet to meet local utility needs. And the utilities were really looking at other options for meeting their energy needs, including importing liquefied natural gas from other countries. And so the timing of it worked out really well, and we were able to sell the power to Chugach Electric. We constructed the project in 2012, and we have been delivering clean, renewable wind energy to Chugach since that time.
Now, I don't understand, because this project is about half the size that it could be. And so it's like, whatever, phase one, you call it?
We called the first one phase one.
Yeah. And why can't phase two simply sell more power to Chugach Electric? Why does Chugach Electric say, oh gosh, there'd be a problem there?
Well, it wouldn't necessarily need to be to Chugach Electric. There are 6 utilities here in the Rail Belt, and we've certainly spent a lot of the last 2 years marketing the second phase of Fire Island to the other utilities. And in the Lower 48, there's no question that we would be constructing the second phase of Fire Island next year, or actually this year, 2015 already. But unfortunately, there's just not the right regulatory and legislative framework here in Alaska to allow us to do it. But
I thought you had a customer. Didn't Golden Valley. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's kind of far away. It's all the way up in Fairbanks. But wasn't there a possibility, some kind of contractual deal with them?
We were working with them, and we thought that we were going to get an agreement with them. And what we offered them was $63 a megawatt hour power, 6.3 cents a kilowatt hour, to a utility that generates half of its power at 13.6 cents. So this is like less than half of the cost to generate their own power. But they couldn't see their way through it. By the time they transport the power across another utility's system to get it up to Fairbanks, they turned it into something that they estimated was 20 cents a kilowatt. And so they didn't see the benefit for it. But if I was trying to sell this power in any state in the Lower 48 and the utility was generating at that rate, they absolutely would have no choice but to purchase this power, and it would be to their ratepayers' best interest to do so, because it would bring down the cost of their power.
So now there's a pending regulatory thing. Would you anticipate these things? I've watched them happen at the Regulatory Commission, and they're not very quick. You know what I mean?
No, in fact, this one, I think it was brought more than a year ago, and I'm not sure what the statutory timeline for it is, but I'm happy to see that the commission is going to hold a meeting tomorrow to discuss it some more, and so maybe there's going to be an announcement. I think they recognize that the regulations haven't been changed since 1982, and they're out of date, and we differed from what the rest of the United States was doing at the time, because we were different and we were small and we were getting our feet under us. But times have changed, technology has changed, and it's time for us to move forward.
I guess we have to explain that this is not federally regulated. This is state regulated. So in the Lower 48, it would be under the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, but as I understand, Alaska's not?
That's correct. We don't have any power that we transmit outside of the state of Alaska, so we're essentially exempt from FERC regulation. However, we do have our own state regulatory commission, and they certainly have the power and the ability to follow the guidance that FERC puts out and then tweak it or modify it as necessary to fit Alaska.
So I'll turn back to you, Bob Kahn, to maybe give us some idea of how FERC has proceeded on this. It took them a while?
Well, it did, and there were some legal challenges. But the long and short of it is that FERC has continued to be committed to the competitive paradigm, which is to say, if you can show that you can generate electricity from resources that you can tap, local resources, renewable resources, things that would otherwise be wasted, like waste heat coming off of a biomass boiler, and you can convert that cost effectively into electricity, then your utility, at least an investor-owned utility, is required by law to purchase that power. It's a very fundamental principle, and it has spurned a lot of innovation. And, you know, frankly, I'm well aware, being here in Seattle, that I'm, you know, your nearest neighbor, but not, you know, conversant with what's going on in Alaska. But the fact is that, as I look at it, Alaska has a terrific opportunity to put into play its principles and commitments of self-reliance by generating electricity from its own indigenous local resources. And I'd be happy to give you some examples of how that's done in a, you know, similarly inclined state like Idaho, for instance.
I want to, how did they solve the peak problem? I mean, as I understand, the argument in Anchorage with the wind farm is that the wind, the energy is going to be produced when there's wind moving. And there's limited storage capacity, hardly any at all. And the load is obviously going to be on some curve that's different from that. And something has to deal with that. With that load, because otherwise you're going to lose reliability. And
Suzanne's probably better able to answer it in specifics, but from a general standpoint, again, this is not rocket science. It is the responsibility of utilities to manage electricity as it's coming in and as it's required by consumers. This is something they are generally very good at, and it's their principal responsibility. The fact is that load, you know, consumer demand also fluctuates just as other sources of electricity fluctuate. Renewables are intermittent. They blow when they blow, at least wind does. Other resources can be managed on a flat basis. But again, this is something that if you want to do it, you can do it. It's not an engineering problem that Alaska faces right now. I can't be blunt enough about this. It is a political and regulatory issue you are facing, which comes down to a question of political will. Does the state of Alaska, like the lower 48, want to see competition in the generation of electricity, or does it want to continue to rely on regulated monopolies?
Well, and I would just say that
a
couple of responses to that. First of all, the Alaska Rail Belt is set up for increasing the amount of renewable power it has in the system. And the reason for that is because we generate 90% of our electricity from natural gas. We have multiple turbines all across the rail belt that are running. These are the types of equipment that are installed in the lower 48 for the very purpose of integrating intermittent resources. And yet we have them, you know, 90%. We don't have coal, we don't have nuclear. For the most part, we have very flexible natural gas generation, which can easily integrate intermittent renewable resources.
It is flexible, then.
It is flexible.
Now, I wish I had somebody from a utility here to say, well, no, it's not that simple.
Well, and just to put some perspective into it, you know, with the addition of Fire Island Wind, and then, of course, Golden Valley built their own Eva Creek Wind Project, we're now up to about 5% wind power in the rail belt. And you can compare that to other states which are more aggressively pursuing renewables and have a 50% wind penetration in their system. I mean, we are barely scratching the surface, and like Bob says, this is not about do we have the engineering capability, do we have the equipment on the system to integrate. This is an attitude issue, and this is a regulatory issue and a legislative issue.
Well, okay, I guess the show's over. 1-800.
No, it's just begun.
1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, and email is talk@alaskapublic.org, and they're using them all. But go ahead, Bob Kahn, I think you wanted to interject.
Well, I do. I just, you know, it's probably a little cruel to suggest thinking about a place as warm as Texas for you right now. But if you were to think of yourself in Texas on any given day, as much as Suzanne was saying, 50%, sometimes a little more, sometimes a little less, of the electricity used during the course of the day will be generated by wind power. And the reason for that is that Texas is a state that gets it. They understand that they want to make use of every form of local energy that they have. We know them for oil and gas, but they are the largest generator of electricity in the lower 48 by far. And it's not California. It's Texas. So that tells you that this is really not an ideological question exactly. This is just common sense and a commitment to promote competition so that it can create self-reliance.
Well, all right. Why don't you go back to your Idaho example?
Well, I'd love to. You know, Idaho Power, which we like to say is the state of Idaho, is named after its utility. So Idaho Power is an extremely influential organization in Idaho. Catch this, folks. 30% of the electricity in the Idaho Power system is generated by small producers of wind power, cogeneration, I can explain what that is if you like, generators of biomass energy, wood processors, hydroelectric plants, and geothermal plants. Close to 30% of the capacity in the Idaho Power Electric System is provided by entrepreneurs who own and operate power plants within the state of Idaho. They are only paid, by the way, when they generate electricity. They are not paid just to be there, although maybe a small capacity charge, but fundamentally their commitment is to perform. And when they perform, they're rewarded by a price set with the concurrence of the Utility Commission in Boise. So that's a classic example, probably one of the best in the country, of how you can organize yourself so that you can tap into your local entrepreneurial talent, attract capital, and develop local indigenous resources to good effect.
Okay, let's go to Don, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Don.
Good morning and welcome. I've been up here since 68. This has got to be one of the best programs I've ever heard. Hats off to Siri.
All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, I was also up on a rail belt, excuse me, for a couple of years. And I don't know if they're still doing it today because I haven't been up in Fairbanks lately, but Golden Valley used to use an awful lot of coal up there to generate their electricity by way of Healy.
Yes, but, they still do.
The biggest headache I've found in trying to develop the stuff here has been the local conflict with the politicians and the bureaucrats, primarily in the borough. Of note, again, hats off to Siri, because you folks gave the city of Anchorage and our mayor and whatnot the opportunity to take advantage of the wind farm, and they snubbed it. That was the bottom line. Of course, Chugach jumped on it. But I was also a member of Chugach Electric some years ago when I first came up here. But the catch-all is I've been around to some of the displays and things like down here on 9th Avenue and whatnot during the summertime. Some of the interesting facets that have come up is that up here in Alaska, I've been told by the people who are in the business of setting these things up, that you are probably better off to just simply go ahead and put in two arrays of solar panels as opposed to, say, using one array that is tracking the sun. I found this very interesting because in the wintertime is when you most need it, and it's most difficult to get. And I have seen a few big solar panel systems in Anchorage, which some people may look at them and not even realize what they're looking at. For example, the south side of what used to be NBA down there at, I think it's 5th and E Street, that entire wall on that building, that south wall, if you look closely, you suddenly discover that it's not just a glass wall. That is solar panels. And there's a couple of apartment houses around town. I looked, did a double take when I first saw them. I looked at that thing, and my God, that panel must be at least 10 feet by 10 feet. And several of them up on top of the building. And I was, didn't contact anybody to see what kind of performance they were getting. But it does work up here. Some years ago, some stats came out and said Anchorage gets approximately the same amount of sunlight during January, including the residual that reflects off snow, as does the area where I'm from, Cleveland, Ohio. Hmm. And it's just a matter of how it's going to be put to use. One of the facets the city likes to argue with is, well, you can't put it in because you're going to make a hot line when the power goes down, and you've got to have all these various other safety features and contraptions in order to make sure you're not feeding back into the line when the lineman goes up there to work on it. Kugak Electric also agrees with this. I've spoken with some engineers down there, and they say there are ways to correct this. There are ways to get around it. One of them, of course, is having yourself a small setup, solar, wind, whatever, and have it there mainly as backup or as sockets that are used, specific outlets such as something to operate LED lighting or something in your home when the regular power fails. Hmm. This is the kind of thing that would not necessarily feed into the grid, but it is something that you would have a standby. It is something that overall would still reduce the cost of your electric bill.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I'm thinking right here at Alaska Public Media, we have a backup generator system, and we have a whole separate, so there are certain plugs that you know you use when we're on the generator because the other ones aren't going to work. It's not hard to do this at all.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
I have LED lighting in my existing dwelling that I'm sitting in right now, and some people are amazed. They don't even want to believe me until I show them the bill. My last 2 months together for my electric was under $100.
Uh-huh. Well, congratulations.
So, yeah, it can be done. It takes some persistence. It takes some willpower. It takes some foresight for investment on a local level, local meaning, including the individual homeowner.
Uh-huh.
And you have to be willing to shell out a few thousand here or whatever, which for most people, that's your limit on a credit card. I mean, but it's there. You can use it in the form of a hybrid backup system for your water heater. There's many, many different applications that you can make to it to save yourself money and go more efficient and modern.
Yeah,
and,
Don, you're. I think I'm talking here to an early adopter. I think we'll call you that.
Oh, you will. Okay. Anyway, I'm all in favor of looking more seriously into what Idaho's been doing down there. I think it's something the Alaska government at both the city, borough, and state level should get busy and do some really serious scrutinizing and not just ridiculing.
Right. Uh-huh. Well, I think that there's no question that people are really going to start implementing their own technology in their own homes, whatever they can do to cut down their energy bills. In Alaska, we have the highest residential electric rates in the country. And so when people start looking at, well, can I save money? Is there something I can do to implement myself? I definitely think you're going to start seeing that more.
Don, I want to thank you for your call.
Alaska has, there's no centerpiece up here for manufacturing per se. And I see little or no reason why we can't get busy and be manufacturing solar panels or windmill components or something for use up here as well as shipment elsewhere.
Wow. Yeah. Thanks. Love your vision there, Don. Right now, one of our biggest manufacturers is a bakery in Spinard. I'm serious. hey, Bob Kahn, I want to turn to you, see if you, I'm sure you've heard this before. We're endangering our linemen. Don't you understand? Somebody could get hurt here.
Well, look, you know, again, this is, first of all, Don is to be commended for his foresight, no question about it. The cost of solar energy and the precipitous, dramatic decline in cost of solar energy is one of the great stories in the energy industry. There's no question about it. But it's not something for everybody. And I think at the same time, as we look at enabling people to chart their own course and, you know, supplying their own electricity for their own uses, primarily for their own uses with possible sale back utility, which is a model we call net metering, that's a great thing to do. But let's really also continue to focus on the overall requirements, as Suzanne mentioned, that Alaskans are paying too much for electricity, that they needn't pay that much, and that the economic development potential of building an industry to supply cost-effective, affordable, and clean electricity within Alaska can help raise the tide of all boats.
But
I think that's really an important focus, particularly as the legislature begins to take this matter up. The opportunities are virtually unlimited. And, you know, again, back to Idaho. Idaho is an interesting state. It doesn't, at first blush, look like it has costly electricity. It doesn't, because it relies heavily on a hydro system that is, you know, an inheritance from the foresight of, you know, grandfathers, grandmothers that, you know, built dams, had the courage to do that way back when. But as a percentage of the pocketbook or the percentage of the cash balance of Idaho residents, many of which are, you know, at poverty levels, it is very significant. So when you think about the social equity issues here and the best solution to bringing down costs and cleaning up the system and making it more energetic is, frankly, to tap into people's own initiative and their entrepreneurial spirit.
Suzanne, you do still want to have something to...
Yeah, I was just going to comment on something that Don said, which, you know, I totally support. Would love to see more manufacturing up in Alaska, but those types of industries rely on reasonably priced energy. And while we're the highest in the country on residential, we're the second highest on industrial and commercial. Well, I might actually have that backwards. I think we pay the most for industrial and commercial rates of anyone in the country. And you know, it's difficult to have a manufacturing business with those kinds of power costs. You know, they have to pull back. That hurts our jobs. It hurts our ability to be prosperous as individuals.
Yeah. And of course, they're already up against the logistical transportation, all the other things when you're trying to manufacture hard goods. But we got some bicycle people that are managing to do it now.
Yeah.
It's quite amazing. Really, really interesting. Bicycle design coming out of Alaska. This is pretty interesting. David in Kenai, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hello.
Hi.
Couple corrections and then into the meat of it. Alaska does not have the highest rates in the country. We are second highest spam consumption after Hawaii, and we are the second highest utility rates after Hawaii.
Thank you.
We're not the highest, we're the second highest.
All right.
And regulated monopolies in the 48 states on the coast, Con Ed, PG&E, are, yes, you know, evil investor-owned utilities extracting profit. The regulated monopolies on the rail belt are all democratically governed, member-owned cooperatives or municipal power companies. So it is a different beast up here than on the east or west coast of the 48 states. But to the claim that it's not an engineering problem, the turbines are in place. The natural gas turbines, increasingly combined cycle, more efficient ones, are in place. And yes, they can be ramped up and down to respond to intermittent sources like wind or potentially in the distant future tidal. But there are engineering aspects that you only get so many hot starts, cold starts, of a turbine before you have to overhaul it. So starting a turbine is $4,000, $5,000 each time you do it. And each turbine has a certain sweet spot where it's most economic in terms of the natural gas consumed, and ramping it up and down moves it out of those most efficient spots.
Mm-hmm.
Probably more fundamental is you can only move 75 megawatts of power off the Kenai Peninsula, where there's more generation and Bradley Lake significantly, into Anchorage, and you can only move 75 megawatts of natural gas-fired power from the Anchorage Bowl north to Golden Valley, who, you know, loves to get natural gas power instead of naphtha fired. And that 75 megawatt transmission limit is constrained by renewables. When Fire Island Wind ramps up and down, that uses some of that capacity and reduces the ability, for instance, to move Bradley Power north. So you actually have some new renewables fighting older renewables for capacity on that line. And new transmission runs about $1 million a mile. And I don't hear the IPP saying, yeah, we'll build that 200-mile line to bring our power to market. Typically, they want legislation to plug into the existing grid to provide energy only and not capacity.
Oh, David, this is fun. Thank you.
Sure.
All right. I think it's a good time to take a break and come back and see where we go next as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. Over the years, Alaskans like you have donated over $10 million to nonprofit organizations benefiting everything from Alaska's youth to the arts to healthcare. You've even donated to public radio to keep quality programming alive and well in Alaska. So come on, Alaska, warm your heart by sharing your PFD. Pick, click, give. This message on Alaska Public Media comes from ExxonMobil and Rasmussen Foundation.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
We're talking about the grid and the independent generation of electricity. And our last caller from down in Kenai really leaned on the grid and said, wait a second. Wait a second. You have to realize that there are costs involved in having your gas. Okay, you do have flexible generation from gas-fired turbines, but you still have to turn them on and off, and there's a cost associated with that. And he went on to say as well that there are a number of places in the grid itself where capacity is simply limited, and we really need to build more infrastructure. And so I think we'll turn to Robert Kahn of the Northwest and Intermountain Power Producers Coalition, because I have a hunch you've heard that sort of thing before.
Right. And, you know, and again, I'm your next-door neighbor, but I'm not up in Alaska. I will not claim to be fully conversant with the, you know, unique situations that you're facing. I think what the caller described was a very coherent summary of an engineering challenge and yet a solvable one. Really, in essence, what this comes down to is a matter of intent. When we get organized here, if it's in the Northwest or other parts of the lower 48, and the intention is to open up markets, to open up opportunities for multiple generators of electricity, and to manage the transmission system equally, equitably, so that everyone has access to it, just as you would have equal access to, say, the interstate highway system, you create a different attitude and you create a different approach to solving your engineering problems. All of the things that David described do have costs associated with them, and he's right. There are engineering and machine impacts in having a combined cycle unit turn on and off. But the frequency for when that happens and the opening up of available transmission capacity is better coordinated when it's coordinated among multiple parties, all pursuing the same goal, which is to open up the transmission system so it can accommodate the delivery of least cost energy.
Oh, so I'm starting to think that, and I think Chugach has been pushing for this, and I'm not sure who all else, but the idea that maybe a separate entity should be in charge of the transmission lines as opposed to owning also the generation capacity.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up, Bob. Let me just kind of describe how it works in the Rail Belt. We have six different utilities. I think five of them own transmission. And so if you want to be an IPP or even another utility that sells excess power to another utility, you often have to cross multiple systems. And in doing so, you incur multiple wheels, multiple imbalances.
I love that, wheels. Stop right there. What is that?
That just means the rate that a utility charges to move power across its system.
Wow. Well, now there is a cost, right?
There is a cost.
Yes and no. Think about it as a tollway instead of an interstate highway system that's free.
Yeah.
Okay?
All right.
So multiple tollways to get energy from one place to another.
Oh, I see. But right now it's to the point where they can kind of say, well, this is what it really costs us. And there's no real, in the regulatory framework, nothing to say, no, actually, you should only charge a nickel for that, not 75 cents.
Right, and there's nobody really looking over it. So let me just insert something. Yeah. I would love to hear from all your callers, but, you know, David did have some very substantive comments.
Very.
And frankly, at the beginning, he made a clarification between the types of ownerships of utilities in your part of the world and lower 48, and it is a distinction with a difference, at least it can be. If your utilities are consumer-owned, then certainly they're accountable to the public. But if we've learned nothing else from this call, this is, you know, look, on a big-picture basis, it's pretty easy to understand. But when it gets technical and it gets technical fast, it gets very complicated to understand. And for regular citizens to pay attention to some of the nuances and some of the, you know, power issues, and I mean political power issues involved in the utility system, is very challenging for the public. So the long and short of it is that a monopoly is a monopoly. How it's regulated could matter, but at the end of the day, we've found here in the Lower 48 that we've benefited from a coherent vision promoting competition, promoting openness, promoting the development of entrepreneurial, you know, creativity that I think, frankly, really suits Alaska, too. And that's the direction I hope you go in.
Okay, I want to try and go to Mike down in Fairbanks here. Mike, I know you were trying to get through on the cell phone there.
Yeah, hi, good morning.
How you doing?
I'm good. This is Mike in Fairbanks, and I own the Delta Wind Farm. Hi, Suzanne.
Good morning.
Hey, I'd like to respond to the last caller, a few of his comments, if I could.
Go ahead.
And I'll start out with the power line issue. You know, The Rail Belt grid is in disrepair right now. It's been estimated that it needs $1 billion worth of infrastructure upgrades just so it doesn't fail at some point in the near term future. $1 billion, and just FYI, there is a private company that has come to Alaska and said, hey, we're interested in making that investment and being regulated by the RCA to come up with a tariff that would be appropriate. So there is action by an independent tower producer, in a sense, to come up here and do some of that power line work. Now, at this point, he doesn't have the permission. The second one I want to talk about is spinning reserve. And the bottom line is, in Fairbanks, for example, we import 70 megawatts of gas power from Anchorage. And to do that, we have to bring it up 300-plus miles of power line, and it is considered non-firm power. Therefore, it requires spinning reserve, because if the power line goes down or something else happens to the generation side, we have to be ready to step in and provide that 70 megawatts. So the whole time we're buying power from Anchorage, we're spinning our turbine down at North Pole. And that's a fact. So that spinning reserve is taking place irregardless of whether it's wind power or gas generated power. And I want to talk about the risk taking potential here. Just in the last 2 years, Anchorage has built two and a half times capacity with respect to gas generation. And one of those power plants doesn't even have a fuel source at this point in time. And all of those costs get rolled into what's called the base rate. The base rate has nothing to do with what it costs to produce the actual kilowatt hour of power. It has to do with the overhead that the utility has basically saddled the public with.
You're giving me a headache here, Mike. Go ahead.
Okay.
I'm getting a little sick to my stomach.
You're
even
replacing other sources, okay? I can guarantee you there isn't an IPP in the state of Alaska that would think for 1 minute in time that we could displace Bradley Lakes at 5.5 cent power. It's just not going to happen. In fact, the grid is so poor right now, the state of Alaska can't even take full advantage of Bradley Lakes. It's back to that billion-dollar problem we talked about. So the bottom line is, if an IPP comes on and tries to provide power, it has to be competitive. It has to be at or below the actual avoided cost. And so there's not anybody that's going to be able to compete with Bradley Lakes. So Bradley Lakes is safe. And for the most part, coal is too. It's the gas plants, the oil plants. Those are the ones that are the high cost and variable power. They can respond. And to this base rate issue, you know, IPPs are only interested in competing against the actual fuel source. So, like, for example, Suzanne's Wind, she had a chance to provide Golden Valley Electric Association with 6.5 cent power, which would have displaced, by the way, 37 cent a kilowatt hour power. That's what it cost at North Pole to produce power. So that would have been, I don't know, 29 cent saving per kilowatt hour to Golden Valley. But at the same time, Golden Valley's base rate of 10.2 cents per kilowatt hour wouldn't have changed one bit whether they make power or not. They've bonded us into oblivion, and we can't change the base rate. But what we can do is we can bring down the fuel cost rate. And that pretty much wraps up my little scenario here. And one last thing, I guess, democratically controlled. I'm trying to digest that. That was the description he used for the utilities in Alaska. You got six utilities in the Rail Belt grid that are all small in comparison to anything in the lower 48. So the redundancy in CEOs, vice presidents in charge of this, vice presidents in charge of that, it's extremely expensive to do it the way we're doing it. And there's no democracy here. To be a board member on Golden Valley's Electric Association, I have to be recommended by the board to even run for the board. That's not democratically controlled. That's a monopoly.
Okay. You got more, Mike?
We can take some of this risk on. We can be innovative. We're quicker to action. And we have something to offer this state. That's about it.
So, hey, Steve.
Yeah, go ahead, Bob.
This is Bob Kahn from Seattle. So what a refreshing conversation. We could go on and on. I do want to take this opportunity to blatantly advertise a movie that our organization produced, which you kindly put on the Alaska Public Radio website. The film is called Risk Takers. Mike, of course, epitomizes that kind of risk taker, as does Suzanne. Ladies and gentlemen who are listening, if you have the time, take a look at the movie. It makes a very strong case for what independent power producers do in the lower 48, particularly here in the Pacific Northwest. I think you relate to a lot of the stories. And don't get turned off by the fact that there's a picture of an endangered bird on the cover of the video. Just click on it, give it a listen. I think you'll be worth your time.
Yeah, some people did complain about that bird. Yeah, Mike, thanks for calling in and clarifying that. I mean, you have quite an investment here, don't you?
Well, I've invested $7.5 million. I was 50 years old in 2007, and had done pretty well in Fairbanks with real estate development and other businesses, and decided that I wasn't ready to retire. And I heard all the rhetoric out there with the state energy policy. I saw the federal subsidies that were available to renewable energy projects. I was watching the people around me choking on the air here in Fairbanks, and I thought, you know what, I could do something about this. And so I went after it, and there was nobody standing beside me at 40 below zero when the wind was blowing 50 miles an hour and my life was on the line trying to figure out where the best place to put a wind farm was. There was nobody standing beside me when we were out there standing up these 250-foot tall towers that have 68,000-pound generators at the top of them. It's very dangerous work, and we went out there and did it because we heard the public say they wanted it. We heard the government say they wanted it. We heard the government talk about energy security, and we wanted to be part of that. And we felt like, as Alaskan entrepreneurs, we could tackle some of those problems. I had no idea that I was going to have to get involved with changing the entire state regulatory policy in order to build a little Podoc One farm in Delta Junction, Alaska, to somehow make my life a little better in Fairbanks and help my neighbors with some of their issues as well. And that's where we're at here. And we do have something to offer, and we can help. And, you know, I saved Golden Valley Electric Association $1 million last year between what they paid me for the 2 megawatts that I have online. By the way, they capped me at. I wanted 24. I've got 6 empty foundation holes that have been sitting there for 4 years for the rest of these turbines that we were going to put in. And we saved them money last year. We took 300,000 gallons of diesel out of the air last year. And, you know, that's another aspect of this. If we can use alternative resources and not burn hydrocarbons, that means, in a sense, we have more hydrocarbons to export. And everybody's chasing more oil in the pipeline. Well, you know, you can do it with electricity, too. We can export electricity.
All right, Mike, thank you very much. Mike, Delta Wind Farm, who clearly he's put his bucks on that thing. And I guess it would. He brought up this subsidy thing. Would Fire Island Wind have worked if it weren't for federal subsidies?
In Alaska, given what we're paying for electricity right now, it probably would work if we were to develop phase two of Fire Island and sell that energy to Golden Valley. It would probably still make sense. But obviously, all the other states in the country, or most of the other states in the country, have taken advantage of those tax incentives. We're all paying into the system. We should be getting something out of it. And I really wish that we were developing phase two this year and taking advantage of it. Because last go round, we were the only wind project in Alaska that was able to take advantage of that federal tax credit.
So right now, where does it stand with part, what do you call it, phase two?
Phase two?
Yeah.
Well, we're on hold at the moment. You know, one of the things that you need in order to develop a project is a long-term PPA, something that ensures that you're going to have revenue so that you can pay off the debts that you incur in order to build the project. And we just were not able to get Golden Valley or Chugach or MLMP to sign up for the power. So We'll take a step back. We'll reassess. We'll allow these utilities, who many of whom are building new generation and trying to get that online, and they're doing that with the staffs that they have, and they just don't really seem to have the bandwidth to look at other options at this point.
Let's go to Doug. Joins the program. Oh, we better take the break now, I think, Dave, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Enroll now in the Health Insurance Marketplace. Sign up at healthcare.gov. Open enrollment ends February 15th. Depending on your income, age, and family size, you may be eligible for discounts that may lower your monthly costs and out-of-pocket expenses. Pick a plan that is right for you and your family. Call 211 for free individual assistance about the Health Insurance Marketplace. Visit GetCoveredAlaska.org for more information. This message sponsored by ASHNA, a partner of Get Covered Alaska.
Well, it's different in Alaska, but just how different is it? We're talking with Robert Kahn, director of the Northwest and Intermountain Power Producers Coalition, and Suzanne Gibson, senior director of energy development at Cook Inlet Region Incorporated. We're talking about independent generation of electricity. Back to you, Bob Kahn, on this issue of having to keep something spinning in case another source doesn't come on. How did the power distributors handle this in a highly distributed system like they have in Idaho now?
Well, it's highly distributed. The units of generation are highly distributed, but the dispatch, or the management, if you will, of the different resources is centrally located in Boise, and the transmission engineers are well conversant with how to, you know, switch on and off to meet various conditions. Of course, the utilities there will describe it as they choose to, and they'll describe it in a way that, you know, resembles how our friend David described it earlier. But I just want to step back for just a second and make a point here, which I think is very fundamental. When we talk about electricity, we really are talking about, if you will, the essence of civilization. If you imagine what happens, and hopefully you don't have to imagine it very often, although you had a local outage, I understand, in parts of the state just last night, when the lights go off, when you lose your power, everything changes. Your connection to the world changes. You might be at risk in terms of your own health and safety. Electricity is an absolutely indispensable commodity to civilization. We need the best brain. We need the best engineering capability and commitment to doing it. And the utilities are natural monopolies when it comes to distributing electricity and managing it in for reliability. Nobody wants the lights to go off when the Super Bowl comes on Sunday. Go Hawks! You know, we count on
you got it in there. You Seattle,
we count on that. But I'll tell you something else that's important, and you know, not as important as the Super Bowl, perhaps, but it's really important. When you have distributed sources of electricity, like Suzanne's wind farm, or like say a cogeneration power plant at a hospital, where the hospital is able to keep its lights on in an emergency, or take heat from its heating system and run electricity simultaneously off of the waste heat. Now you have a little power plant near where people live and work. And if there is a terrible contingency, like an earthquake, heaven forbid, or a normal outage that happens in the course of you know, just life, a power line goes out or whatever, then those units that are distributed, that have been developed, by the way, by independent power producers typically, are going to be running. And they're going to be a source of heat and safety for Alaskans that wouldn't be there otherwise.
You know, we've had a situation here.
When we talk about reliability, we cannot just let the utilities define it in their own terms. Because at the end of the day, the public is at the end of that hook. And if we, as individual citizens with initiative like Mike, want to step up and develop that system further, we should be recognized for also contributing to reliability in the system.
I was just thinking, we heard from Dave about how some of the power lines are limited in capacity, and there we have had times when just an avalanche basically shut down the intertie to the Kenai Peninsula, and they suddenly don't have the Bradley power, and there has been like a brownout situation. We actually have had some of this, so I can really take to heart the idea of wanting to be a little closer to my power plant. I was a little bit put off when Chugach built a power plant not too far from my house down by the tracks. And I thought, what is this giant industrial facility going to be in my neighborhood? But I've kind of gotten to like the idea. Even the plume that comes out of there every now and then, it's a little bit comforting to me. And now I know why. Let's go to Doug.
Well, maybe. Yes, maybe. Go ahead.
Let's go to Doug. Well, it's, yes, gas fired. It seems to be pretty good. The plume is...
No, it's just that they're uplifting. They are generating at such a high voltage, Steve, that's going into the main grid. That's not at a voltage level like it would be if it were a local, you know, hospital, that it's closer to where you take your electricity, you see. So, again, it gets complicated, but the fundamentals are not complicated, and I hope I've conveyed that to your listening audience. This stuff can work if we commit as a community and as a state to making it work.
And it seems like we got a ways to go yet. Let's go to Doug, joins the program from Palmer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Doug, and thanks for waiting.
Yeah, fine. Great show. Well, I was just wondering if your guests could comment on Susitna Dam project here in Alaska and how it would fit in and if it's a good deal for us.
Okay, well, I don't know. Have you heard about this idea of a kind of a mega dam in between the load centers in Alaska, Robert, or can we pass this one on to Suzanne?
No, I'd rather pass it on to Suzanne.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sure you've heard about it.
I have heard about it, of course.
We've had them in here talking about it. And, you know, is the idea, look, if you really want to go renewable and the state would hit its goal, this would be the best way to get there. You know, you've got to make a dam.
Well, it's one way to get there. And it's a really, really big mega project. The estimated cost of it is $5.2 billion. It's at least a decade out before it could be constructed. And it certainly does require a full upgrade of the transmission system in order to bring on such a large resource into one area. But I think that, you know, we tried to develop this project, I think it was back in the 80s, and we spent about $180 million on the studies at that time. And then I'm not sure what all the reasons were behind why it got shelved, except that it was such a big project and so costly.
I remember very well. Basically, the report from the financiers came out and it said, you have no problem. You can build this easy. Just use your permanent fund. That was the end of it.
That was the end of it. Well, it may have the same, you know, result this time around, given where we are.
All right. I'm gonna put Harry Crawford on again. I believe he's on the board at Chugach Electric, and he's got a long history in organized labor and run for office and been on the show a number of times. Harry, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Good morning, Steve.
How you doing? So how come Chugach can't buy more power from that wind farm?
Well, I mean, the whole thing gets complicated in the details, but it is to our advantage all along the rail belt to have independent produced power and diversify our generating system. I'm in favor of independent power producers, and the way to get that, I believe, is to have a unified system operator on the rail belt, to have economic dispatch of power, and to get storage into the system would make it a whole lot easier, so that we didn't have to actually drop power at some times. Apparently, we dropped about 10% of Fire Island this last year, which is way below the national average. So it's really good, but still, that's 10% of power that we pay for that we were unable to use because of the way that the system works. So what I would suggest for people along the rail belt that want more renewable energy and independently produced power is to get involved in your board of directors and pay attention to who's being elected and what they stand for.
Hey, Harry, we're running out of time, but I want to get the thoughts of both sides, because it sounds like we have a little bit of a consensus here on this. Unified system operator. In other words, it's a separate entity that distributes the power. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Okay. And Robert Kahn, you kind of go along with that recommendation?
I do. I say amen to what Harry just had to say, and I'm delighted to hear it.
And do you think... even when they're all co-ops, when the municipalities and co-ops,
They should be all the more responsive to the public need.
Well, I mean, I don't know how you do the board or anything like that. Suzanne, you're out of time for your comments here on that.
Well, just generally say that I agree with Harry's comments and that would save us money right from the get-go.
I want to thank you so much for coming in today, Suzanne Gibson of Siri, and, it was great to have your insight, and I think we all learned a little something on this. Robert Kahn, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And from Seattle, you can say go Seahawks again if you want.
I'm going to say go Hawks. You know, we're going to whoop them. It's going to be great. Don't miss it. Make sure your power's on.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks to Dave Waldron, Evan Erickson, and Josh Edge. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.